only God would give me some sign. If he would just speak to me once. Anything, one sentence, two words. If he would just cough.
Of course there's a God. We're made in his image.
You think I was made in God's image? Take a look at me. You think he wears glasses?
Not with those frames.
Despite humorists like Woody Allen, the question of God's existence is no laughing matter. From law to morality to our own eternal existence, everything crumbles with God out of the picture. Discover why this week on Just Thinking with author and apologist Ravi Zacharias. Friedrich Nietzsche has been dead for a long time, yet his philosophy is still with us. Yesterday, Ravi pointed out the influence Nietzsche's work had on leaders such as Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin. Unfortunately, his rabid atheism has also affected American culture as well. We'll find out how today as we broadcast part three of Ravi's message, Is Atheism Dead? Is God Alive? Here's that presentation.
Do you recall in recent times where the word values was used more often than in the most recent election? It is almost as though with all of our politicizing and all of our advance, there's a specter that won't go away. There's an inner knowing that won't go away. That forces you to ask the question, that forces me to ask the question, how do I really determine what is right, what is wrong? How do I arrive at a moral law? And to this, the atheist is unable to give an answer. Whether he moves from emotivism to subjectivism to prescriptivism, whether he moves from his cognitive theories to his non-cognitive theories, sooner or later, his meta-ethical mind is forced to admit that he's running into collisions on his own theory. Iris Murdoch, professor at Oxford, for example, deals with the Kantian solution to it all. And ironically enough, I'm going to demonstrate for you how Kant stands in the middle between the empirical search of David Hume and Diderot on one side and the existential trauma of Kierkegaard, who was 100 years after the empiricists here. Between them stands Kant. You see, Hume was trying to wrestle with the passions. Diderot was trying to deal with it, wrestling with his desires. And in their own empiricist worldview, they were trying to solve the problem of right and wrong. Kant rejected that empirical approach, came with his own approach of reason. And after the Enlightenment, on the heels of the Enlightenment, existentialism was waiting to be born, and Kierkegaard dismissing the Kantian description of approaching ethics from a point of view of reason. One of the most powerful statements ever made was made by a philosopher of ethics, Robert Fitch, who said this: ours is an age where ethics has become obsolete. It is superseded by science, deleted by psychology, dismissed as emotive by philosophy. It is drowned in compassion, evaporates into aesthetics and retreats before relativism. The usual moral distinctions between good and bad are simply drowned in a maudlin emotion in which we feel more sympathy for the murderer than for the murdered, for the adulterer than for the betrayed, and in which we have begun to believe that the real guilty party, the one who somehow caused it all, is the victim and not the perpetrator of the crime. Somewhere in the struggle, in search, we've tried and tried and tried to rescue it. But you see, Immanuel Kant made a dangerous philosophical mistake. It was a turning point because, as many of you may know, these men, by the way, had very conservative ethical positions. Hume's Presbyterianism shows through whether he likes it or not. Diderot's Jansenist Catholicism shows through whether he likes it or not. In fact, he even voiced his concern that without a telos and without a purpose, ethics was becoming unintelligible. Kant's Lutheranism and Kierkegaard's Lutheranism in some way was beginning to show through in their own philosophical struggles. But Kant actually believed, listen now, Kant said ethics has to be arrived at purely from the vantage point of reason without the introduction of the concept of God and without using happiness as its goal. Without the introduction of the concept of God and without happiness as its goal. Isn't it ironic today where we have lost all three, the concept of ethics, the concept of God, and the concept of happiness too? And Alasdair MacIntyre says the Enlightenment experiment failed. It failed, says McIntyre, because you cannot design an ought unless you know what is. And you cannot design an ethic or a structure, whether you go the Rousseau's route or any other route. He says the telos has to be kept in perspective. And on the heels of the Enlightenment, existentialism was waiting to be born. And on the heels of existentialism, alienation was waiting to be born. Hence the professor's book from England, Colin Gunton, Enlightenment and Alienation. No moral law to turn to. I'm sure you'll have questions on this and we will interact on it. But apart from God, the wrongheadedness of ethics becomes obvious because it's up for grabs. But without the concept of God, atheism runs into the second existential dilemma, and that is the entire dilemma of pain and death, which is inescapable too. If there's one thing you and I learn more and more in life, it is the struggle of pain and death. And if you come from the part of the world that I do, you see it more and more and learn to look at it. In fact, most Eastern philosophies have been born by virtue of the suffering that was seen. Buddhism is a case in point, where Gautama Buddha himself had seen the suffering around and abandoned the precincts of his palace in order to find an answer and find nirvana, some sense of extinguishing from this brutal, material, painful reality that surrounds us. The struggle for a question of pain and death. Camus is the one who said, death is philosophy's only problem. Expanded it even more by saying, now the biggest question therefore is, why not suicide? But as Sartre would have said, that would be to use my freedom to take away my freedom, and that's not a good thing. But the whole issue of hope, the whole issue of hope and how we deal with it. Wilfred Maclay, professor at Tulane University, recently attended a funeral of a young woman friend of his who had died in childbirth. And he went there rather despondent and wrote this article afterwards after listening to the minister speak. And I want you to listen to it, how pointed it is and what his plea was. Where the rest of us had been stunned into reflective silence, awed and chastened by this reminder of the slender thread by which our lives hang, the minister had other things in mind. He did not try to comfort her family and friends, nor did he challenge us to remember the hard words of the Lord's Prayer, "Thy will be done." Instead, he smoothly launched into a well-oiled tirade against the misplaced priorities of our society, in which billions of dollars were being poured into Star Wars research, while young women such as this were being allowed to die on the operating table. That was all this minister had to say. His eulogy was in effect a pitch for less federal spending on defense and more spending on the development of medical technology. The only thing omitted was an injunction that we should write our congressman or Ralph Nader about this outrage. I could hardly believe my ears. Leave aside the eulogy's unspeakable vulgarity and its unintentional cruelty to the woman's family. Leave aside the flabby and cliched quality of language and speech. Leave aside the self-satisfied tone of easy moral outrage. Leave aside the fashionable opinions. I am even willing to concede for the sake of argument that the minister may have been right in everything he said. All of these considerations, though, were beside the point. Nothing can alter the fact that he failed us. He failed her and failed his calling by squandering a precious moment for the sake of a second-rate stump speech and by forcing us to hold our sorrow back in the privacy of our hearts. At the very moment it needed common expression, that moment can never be recovered. Nothing that religion does is more important than equipping us to endure life's passages by helping us find meaning in pain and loss. With meaning, many things are bearable, but our eulogist did not know how to give it to us. All he had to offer was political desiderata. For my own part, I left the funeral more shaken and unsteady than before. Part of my distress arose from frustration that my deepest thoughts and those of around me, I later discovered, were so completely unechoed in this ceremony and in these words. But another part of my distress must have stemmed from a dark foreboding that I was witnessing another kind of malpractice and another kind of death. Where religion through the centuries has historically served in preparing people for life's passages, for the transition at this most difficult moment in life. And you know what is so easy, folks, as academics, as many of us are involved in learning, which is so important in our lives, and rightly so, but when one stands on the wrong side of a funeral procession, your whole worldview is staggered, at least momentarily. And I have stood by two members of my family whom I have buried. And as you stand in that room and look outside the window and realize the tragedy of what has befallen, what does Nietzsche have to say to me? What does Madeleine Murray O'Hare, the popularizer of it all, have to say to me? What do all of these populist philosophies that love to debunk the existence of God, what do they have to give to somebody like Professor McClay here, or to somebody who's looking for life's most searching questions? All right, death is the end. The worms devour my body and I commit my soul to the great perhaps. All right, Bertrand Russell, you build it upon a foundation of unyielding despair. If that is so, why does Jean-Paul Sartre himself, the known existentialist living in such a pleasure-oriented society, who was the ideological godfather for many of the Angkor Laya movement in Cambodia that resulted in the killing of millions ultimately, why did he himself question his own philosophy to a point where his mistress Simone de Beauvoir looks at him stating what he's done, struggling with disavowing now his own principle of trying to arrive at a world of self-authentication apart from any designer in mind, and she says, there you are, he too is going senile. I've documented that entire episode in my book here. Why is it? It is because in the passing life's passages and through the pain which we suffer, more and more you will find out that the struggle for hope is just one that is left unaddressed and is left mutely by the secularist or the man who wants to debunk any concept of God. The atheist unblushingly admits that. Make something of it now. There's nothing more for you beyond this.
Nothing beyond the grave. Talk about a philosophy of emptiness. We've been listening to a message Ravi Zacharias shared at the Harvard Veritas Forum a few years ago. If you'd like to own this message in its entirety, along with the follow-up messages and some extensive question and answer session with Harvard students, we invite you to order a copy. Call us at 1-800-448-6766. And ask for the Harvard Veritas Forum. Our number again is 1-800-448-6766. To learn more about Ravi Zacharias and this ministry, visit us on the web at rzim.org. That's rzim.org. Just Thinking is a listener-supported radio presentation of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Finally, join us tomorrow for the powerful conclusion of, Is Atheism Dead? Is God Alive? Until then, keep thinking.